Welcome to Business Watch. It's the last work week of the year for so many, and time to consider the new reality that is emerging in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic and ask what it means for politics, economics and business into 2022. And while the IMF is cautioning that the Omicron variant could shave a few percentage decimal points of global growth, the figure is still double that of South Africa's expected GDP next year globally. Locally, we've got crony capitalism, blackouts and scant investment that have left the South African economy really on its knees. We're in a second recession in 2 years before the pandemic hit. The virus then pushed unemployment above 30%, and we got anger at decades of graft and the failing economy helping fuel riots back in July. With the large mining industry, South Africans' hopes for a brighter economy next year rest in part on the high prices for what we dig up and export. But how long will it take to fix the deeper problems? Well, to find out what's in store for investors in the year of the tiger, let's welcome our panelists, Gina Schoeman, economist and head of research at Citi, Dr. Lumkile Mondi of the School of Economics and Finance at Wits, and Richard Calland, Associate Professor in Public Law at the University of Cape Town and a founding partner of the Paternoster Group. Well, Gina, thanks for joining us. You look like you've recovered from your recent bout of Omicron. Let's start at the global level. The Economist reporting that the number of people living in extreme poverty is falling again. So that's good news. We had COVID obviously plunging millions into poverty as countries went into lockdown. Broadly speaking, what are your expectations for the global economy next year?
Well, we haven't downscaled in a very big way yet because of Omicron. It's certainly something we're watching very closely, and I think South Africa is a very, very important proxy for what other countries should expect. However, of course, remember that our vaccination rate is still relatively lower than that of other countries, particularly developed countries. So what we're really focusing on is outside of how these waves evolve through 2022 and, of course, how a fifth wave looks, how we can learn to live with Omicron, is also what is it doing to inequality? What is it doing to inflation? Because these waves obviously have quite a big impact on supply constraints, and hence we are all very concerned about global inflation. And then off the back of that, you know, how is this going to impact things such as monetary conditions globally? And there everyone's watching the Fed. Is the Fed going to taper more aggressively? When will rate hikes actually begin? We think they're going to begin earlier than I think the consensus is expecting. And then, of course, what's very also important for South Africa is what's going to happen to China? Mm. Because we're expecting China GDP growth to fall below 5% for the first time pretty much ever since we've been in a democracy. And that is going to have considerable headwinds for a commodity-rich exporter such as South Africa, especially after a year like 2021, where terms of trade really came through as a huge windfall benefit. So those are some of the bigger factors that we're looking forward to in 2022. And then, of course, we've got to take that across South Africa's own domestically orchestrated economy and all of the issues we face.
So one hopes we don't have that Chinese tiger by the tail as it begins to slow down and turn on us a little bit there. Lumkile, what would you like to add to that from the global perspective of what you're expecting next year?
We're expecting a continuation of the global supply constraints. We know that many of our auto companies domestically who are dependent on completely knocked down vehicles have downscaled the expectation in production terms because of challenges that emanate from the lockdowns that were experienced over a year ago. So that's likely really to continue for medium to long term. But also the stimulus that has come through the US should really continue driving growth there. And of course, inflation. So really what we're expecting internationally is rising prices due to supply constraints, but also the stimuli that has been put across by the Americans to push prices high. And therefore, South Africa and many of the emerging markets are also going to be impacted through the supply chains, meaning that their prices also continue to increase, and therefore high inflation across the world, and really very much dependent on what the monetary authorities are doing first in the Fed in the U.S., and the EU central bank, but more importantly also the emerging market central banks on what action they take to fend off inflation when prices are rising, but at the same time, unemployment is increasing and inequality, as Gina said, is widening.
Yeah, and potentially into a slowing economy due to these waves of the coronavirus pandemic not ceasing at this stage, and therefore tightening monetary policy into a slowing global economy. That's always a tricky balancing act. Richard, what do you see as the major themes into the year of the tiger?
Well, let me try and throw a sort of political lens into this. I'm the sort of political rose between the two economist thorns. Formidable minds, both Gene and Lumkili. But what I see is two things. Firstly, there is this big issue around inflation, which seems to be dividing economists. Is this a transitory inflationary surge, or is it going to be something more permanent? And as you know, Michael, the thing that's kept me from sleeping well in recent months and years is a fear that we're sleepwalking into a repeat of the 1930s. Mm. And if this inflationary surge proves to be longer lasting, then that could be yet another piece of evidence to suggest that we might be heading in that very dark direction. The other thing, of course, is vaccination. And it's been obvious that the end game for the pandemic was vaccination. And now that's become a step further, the question of vaccine mandates. And that is really a cutting-edge issue in virtually every major economy. And I'm currently in Europe, as you know, and in Paris specifically. And at the weekend, I observed a quite substantial march against vaccine mandates that was not just the normal band of kind of libertarian nutcases and anarchists. It was middle-class people. It was young. It was old. And it stretched for a good couple of kilometers. So it's a real cutting-edge issue. And Macron here, who is now emerging in Merkel's with Merkel gone as the major multilateralist in Europe, he's got an election to win next year, and he faces a real challenge from the far right, not the left. Merkel's gone. We've got a new, very interesting combination government in Germany. And lastly, unfortunately, we have the fear of war in Europe on the borders with Ukraine. And there are real jitters around that. And of course, that could have a big impact on stability.
So many issues to unpack in that, and we'll come back to inflation, which is running really hot at the moment. I think 1982 was the last time we saw inflation at 6.8% in the US. Interest rates back then, 21.5%. You think the Fed is behind the curve a little bit? But Gina, I want to dive into the pandemic firstly, because what Richard raises is so interesting. We're starting to see a more popular pushback against issues of vaccine mandates, and it's going to be interesting to see how South Africa's approach to the Omicron wave potentially informs the rest of the world, because you've also got the UK now going in the other direction in the face of Omicron, going into tighter lockdowns. We almost take a more Swedish approach. What are you modelling in terms of the early data that's coming out of Omicron in terms of the impact of this seemingly milder version of COVID?
Seemingly milder, but also a lot more infectious. And unfortunately, when it becomes more infectious, even if it's a milder case of the variant than what we've seen previously, it still means it has the ability to impact more people. And unfortunately, South Africa is also behind the curve when it comes to vaccination rates, particularly boosters now. You know, if South Africa had already rolled out its boosters, then arguably it would not be as severe. We wouldn't have to worry too much about the number of cases we're seeing. Look, the early data from wastewater surveillance, from hospital admissions, tells us that this is how a variant does evolve, right? It becomes more infectious, but less severe. So mild just means you basically don't need oxygen or you don't need a hospital. You can treat this at home, however severe it might feel, but you're not going to take over any capacity within the hospitals. But we still have to be very careful because this is still very early days. We haven't yet seen it, you know, increase as much as it has in South Africa and other countries. That'll be very important to watch, given that they have got boosters rolling out, given that they have got higher vaccination rates. And then, of course, we have to play this against an economy that can't afford further fiscal stimulus, so therefore can't really do lockdown restrictions. So then the question is, how do you stop it from spreading? You know, how do we stop Gauteng becoming something, you know, more national in South Africa? And so this is why government is looking at, or let's put it this way, voluntary vaccine mandates. In other words, this isn't our government saying this is a legal requirement necessarily, but we're allowing any given restaurant to decide whether they want people to be vaccinated on their premises or not. And therefore, we'll have to see how compliant or not compliant to the mandates, certain events, sites, social, you know, gatherings are, as to whether this spreads to the point where we need to announce restrictions. But let me just again remind you, restrictions, I know they haven't been as negatively impactful to the economy as we saw originally, but they still are impactful. And we desperately need to create an economy that allows our tourism industry to open up again. I think that's the bottom line for 2022 for South Africa, because this is a sector that is literally on its knees.
Absolutely. And with everyone with one eye on the holiday this week, I'm sure we're acutely aware of how many bookings have become available in five-star lodges, in accommodation that's generally taken up by the German swallows and other tourists that tend to come from our feeder markets in Europe. Economically speaking, Lumkile, how do you see the issue of vaccine mandates playing out? Because, and maybe I'm throwing the ball into the territory of Richard Callender a little bit here, because it is deeply political. We've seen Nedlac and business say they support vaccine mandates to an extent. We've seen the president take a more cautious approach. He rather wants the constitutional court to give government guidance here. How do you see this playing out?
I mean, it's been very encouraging listening from Discovery about the take-up rate within that company. Of course, you could argue that that business sector, including financial services, but in the boards where I'm sitting, we're driving a mandatory approach to vaccine. And we're doing so in the interest of our employees, in the interest of our shareholders, but also our various stakeholders who expect us to deliver on their expectations. So I think where in South Africa it's going is that you're going to find many companies implementing mandatory vaccine strategy, and you're going to find quite a lot of small, medium enterprises also starting to follow suit and breaking ranks, particularly in the hospitality and restaurant sectors, where I am very worried, Michael, of going out when I know that many of these businesses around my area don't even do the basics. They still have got the sanitizers. They don't take the temperature. They don't take the register. Sometimes some of the clients come in with very suspicious cover on their mouth and noses. So really, many of us aren't really supporting these subsectors. So I'm expecting that many of the businesses are going to drive the mandatory. And if we are doing it, many universities, I think Richard at UCT, ourselves at VETS, and many others, we're also pushing for mandatory vaccine because we believe that it's good for education, it's good for the economy, it's good for our society. So I think we're going to see some resistance, but we'll push on.
And the longer we wait, I see Thomas Piketty in your bookshelf in the background there, the deeper the inequality that the persistence of this pandemic is perpetuating throughout South Africa and indeed the world. Richard, I want to come back to the political arena, and obviously we wish the president well as he announced that he's tested positive this morning. How do you see this playing out for the president, who again has probably not led quite as firmly as many would have had hoped on this issue?
Well, that's right. I think, as both Gina and Lumkile indicate, it's not a straightforward issue. There are complexities to it in terms of how you assert and roll out a mandate. But a mandate is necessary, and that should be the pivot. That should be the driving direction of government policy at this point. And I would have expected and hoped the president to be more decisive and bolder on that. He obviously believes it, but he's not willing to say so. And of course, this is his inclination as a leader. When it's delicate and politically risky, he tends to want to share the burden and spread the risk. And of course, that may be appropriate in some cases, but we're trying to get out of a pandemic that's doing huge economic and social harm. I think he should be more decisive. So I think a leadership failure on his part. Of course, the weakness in my argument and the argument we're all putting in favor of mandates is that it's a stronger case when you've got a larger percentage vaccinated. And when you've got a low percentage vaccinated, then it's harder to really push for mandates. And that's a flaw in the whole structure of the government's position. And of course, they've failed, I think, to be effective, firstly, in getting the vaccines in place last year and heading into this year, and then not being very effective at persuading people that they should actually get vaccinated. I mean, these are I'm afraid to say, considerable failures.
Yeah. But in in the context of Bill Gates and his annual letter, and he recognizes, in fact, singles out the ability of social media to spread misinformation. That has been a key highlight of this particular pandemic, where misinformation has been allowed to spread even faster than the highly contagious Omicron variant. So we're operating in unique times. They certainly didn't have Twitter back in 1918 in dealing with the Spanish flu. I want to move on, though, to inflation. And that's the other big story, Gina. Clearly, and as Richard articulated, where do you sit on the spectrum here between transitory and a more general rising inflation? I think the Fed is now parked transitory. It realizes it's got to start raising rates. How do you see this policy normalization playing out next year?
So South Africa is actually quite unique here. And I think that's the first point of departure, is that, yes, the rest of the world is more concerned about inflation because it looks less transitory than what they initially thought. In South Africa, we have a CPI basket that is split pretty much half-half between goods and services. And this is quite unique versus other emerging markets. Most emerging markets have far more of a CPI basket towards goods inflation. Now, South Africa also hasn't grown sufficiently over the last, let's call it, decade. And so this created quite a large output gap. And where I'm getting to with all of this is that we keep getting asked over and over again, why is South Africa's inflation relatively so contained versus a lot of other emerging markets, given the inflation fears coming out globally? And then also, of course, why was the South Africa Reserve Bank seemingly later to the party of starting the normalization process? What I would say to that is that, yes, we are relatively contained, but that's because of an output gap that is so wide and has been so wide for so long. It's created some very unusual supply and demand imbalances in the economy. And the easiest one to just quickly touch on there is that we gave a fake signal that we were always going to grow and we never did. We built too many houses. And as a result of that, rental inflation has been shooting downwards, at least on an inflation rate, for many years now, which is a big part of our services basket. Now, what we have seen is that the difference between South Africa's services inflation and goods inflation is the largest gap we've ever recorded in history in South Africa. And what we have to be careful about is that, yes, relative to what everyone else is experiencing, our inflation looks pretty well anchored around 4.5%, as long as the SARB normalizes gradually and slowly, by roughly 100 basis points going forward, so 1.5%. But we have to watch goods inflation very carefully. Because goods inflation has been rising, that's food and fuel. And we are an emerging market, we're very sensitive to food and fuel, which means we have to watch wages. Because wages can then create an upside risk to inflation that is not transitory. And that is exactly what the normalization process is about. It's about protecting this economy against these upside risks and creating a buffer for the next time we need to drop rates. So I would say the prudent and very orthodox response from our South Africa Reserve Bank is the correct one.
And that's why often I think when the Reserve Bank is criticized for raising interest rates against exogenous factors like goods inflation, rising fuel and food costs, it's not consumer demand, it's not demand pull inflation. The Reserve Bank often gets criticized, but I think a very good point that you raise there, Gina, in that it's doing this in order to contain inflation expectations and wages, which could then spiral out of control. Lumkile, how do you see the Reserve Bank playing this next year? Data dependence, I know, is something that the Fed loves always saying. Do you see Lesesha Kanyago being highly data dependent in an environment with all of these uncertainties and moving parts?
Absolutely. I mean, also appreciating that the global cost, the global supplies, which we're so much dependent on in the production sector, are going to continue. We are just planning, I sit on a board of a company that makes parts for Mercedes and BMW. And we basically had to make orders for our hot rolled coil much earlier this year, because next year the price is going to go up by 25% because of global demand and lack of supplies. So what I'm saying basically that there's going to be so much coming through the production sector because of supply constraint, pushing prices up, and in that process, impacting negatively on the outlook. And I'm sure the Reserve Bank will act accordingly. But as Gina has said, I'm expecting a very low step-up approach of offering 25 basis points every time it meets than a huge 50 basis point or 100 basis point over a short time. So this is going to flow in the next 18 months.
And really, I think being priced in by the market, if you look at the forward rate, the FRA market at the moment. I want to zoom out again to the geopolitics, Richard, and it's quite interesting. If you look at when the plague killed a third of Europeans in the 14th century, it left the landlords with too few hands to till the land, allowing labourers to demand better wages, and the pendulum swung towards labour. We saw a similar populist backlash following the Spanish flu in 1918-19 as well. The pandemics do tend to spur huge shifts in the geopolitical landscape. Prior to the pandemic, we had this rising populism. We now have rising inflation. That's going to impact workers and those who feel disaffected by their governments. Do you see the fans of this new right just being sort of, or the flames, should I say, being fanned by the pandemic into 2022?
Well, that's a big question. I would say there's two kind of scenarios. One is the scenario in which, yes, those flames continue to be fanned because of inequality, because of a kind of backlash against the culture wars or the new norms. And there's a very interesting, it seems to me, Venn diagram that one could draw if one was a good graphic artist, which is the overlap between those who are kind of Trump supporters, Zuma supporters, RET, Bolsonaro, even Boris Johnson, those that are anti-vax, those that are climate denialists, and so on. There's a sort of group there that is significant in societies across the world that is kind of also anti-taking the knee, you can throw that in there, denialists in terms of problems and historical colonization and injustice around race and gender. That's the right wing scenario. The left wing one has, I'm afraid, not emerged yet. And I say that because if it does not emerge, then the right wing one will prevail, most likely. And in previous occasions, most obviously after the Second World War, a social democratic consensus emerged around the welfare state. And that was a huge advance. And from that also advances around protection of human rights internationally and locally. We haven't yet seen that social consensus emerge around a non-right, non-populist vision for the world. It could yet emerge, and it could focus on sustainability and the green economy, but it needs leadership, and it needs someone to articulate it and lead it. And where are those people? I don't see them at the moment, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, certainly a lot of rising in Biden's opinion ratings. If you look at what's happening over in the United States, which tends to lead global thought on this. And there was a study of 133 countries between 2001 and 2018 finds that political unrest tends to peak 2 years after a typical epidemic starts. So if that's the case, then 2022 really is going to be that year. Gene, I want to come back to, just as we've got 4 minutes to go, and I want to unpack China a little bit more. The China Evergrande debt story was the big one this year, and China's debt-fueled expansion, you said China's going to drop below 5% for the first time since it started keeping records, if we can believe them. What does that mean for Xi and China, and particularly us here in South Africa?
Well, I mean, this is China doing what China's always said they would do, is that they're just trying to shift their economy, change the balance of their economy, try to make it a little bit more sustainable. But of course, that means that it's going to be very bad news for any commodity exporter, and there's a whole chunk of those across emerging markets. So it's those type of emerging markets that are going to suffer the most, but we have to get a little bit more nuanced, because we have to try and overlay this with what the US might do in terms of infrastructure plans, which could bolster some of that demand. Mm. You know, so we'll have to see a switch over there. So it's really about examining each of these EM exporters of commodities to find out where their trade relations lie, you know, what the change in commodity prices do. And also, we haven't seen all commodity prices just suddenly come off. I mean, iron ore came off very quickly, but you still have a lot of things going on in the auto sector, which means that your palladium, your platinum might stretch out for a little bit longer. But effectively for South Africa, China is a huge trading partner of ours. You know, if we look at just 2021, the year that we just about to conclude, The windfall benefit that we saw from commodity prices cannot be underestimated this year. I mean, if to think about it in terms of the budget, you know, it allowed our budget to improve by at least a full percentage of GDP, which is huge, right? We're not going to have that windfall next year, even if things just simply normalize. And if anything, we're going to have to do a lot more locally to create our own growth rather than lean on the tailwind of a commodity price cycle. And I think we can all agree that we do not have a very good track record of doing that.
Okay, just a last comment as we've got 30 seconds to go. Limkile, State of the Nation 2022. This year it was the Protea. What do you hope to see the president invoke to provide some hope into this new year?
It's really to lean on the achievement at COP26 around our just transition. So I expect him to push much harder, working with the private sector around exploiting the opportunities that we got from COP26, and therefore in the process drive investment that is green, that repositions South Africa, mining sector specifically, that Gino was talking to, towards greener production, whether it's platinum, whether it's manganese, because we're using and sourcing our energy from green sources. So that's sort of the message that I expect.
Richard?
I agree 100%. That is the big opportunity. That's the sweet spot to aim for. But the president has to deal with his Gwady problem. He's got a minister in this sector who is a fossil fuel and who apparently is doubling down on opposition. He's got to deal with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, from fossil fuel fools to rising populism and more waves of COVID next year and rising inflation, lots to keep investors on the edge. That was Gina Schoeman, who was joined around the table, economist and head of research at Citi, by Dr. Limkile Mondi of the School of Economics and Finance at Wits, and Richard Callan, associate professor in public law at the University of Cape Town, here on Business Watch.